Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Nearly 10 years ago, in the mysterious land of Toronto, Canada, Scott Pilgrim was dating a high schooler. Hello, we are Filibuster, and we're here to talk about Scott Pilgrim vs. the World and be 10 years old and make you feel old and stuff. 1, 2, 3, 4! I'm Dallas King, and with me in the pod booth is the young Neil to my Neil, the Wallace Wells to my Scott Pilgrim, the vegan police to my Todd Ingram. It's Lucas Lee Hutchison. How are you this week?
Chicken isn't vegan? Yeah, I'm good, thanks.
Good, good. So on today's episode, in lieu of the fact that up here in Scotland we have slim pickings in terms of cinemas to actually go to, because that was a plan, the episode was going to be, we were going to talk about what it's like to go back to the cinema, but we haven't been able to go back yet, because basically the major chains don't seem to like the idea of 2 meter social distancing in Scotland, so we're going to have to wait at least another week before we get to experience that. But it just so happens that there was one film that is 10 years old this month, so we figured, why not? Because, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we spent an entire episode talking about the Cornetto trilogy, and today we're talking about Edgar Wright's Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, based on the graphic novel series by Brian Lee O'Malley, starring a cacophony of talent such as Michael Cera, Anna Kendrick, Aubrey Plaza, Chris Evans, Brandon Routh. We've got, who else? Too many people to mention. Jason Schwartzman, of course, as well. But we'll get to all of them in time. But essentially, this is not a superhero movie, but a comic book movie, certainly, released in 2010, and it sees Scott Pilgrim, a Canadian who's in a rock band called Sex Bob-omb, who decides to date a woman called Ramona Flowers, and in order to do that, he must battle her 7 evil exes. That's right, exes, not ex-boyfriends, exes. But there's a reason for that. So this film first came out in 2010, It was, I think the premiere took place at the San Diego Comic Con and then over here at MovieCon in August of 2010. So, Lee, what were your first thoughts about Scott Pilgrim? Not the viewing itself, but since, you know, it was clear that we're all huge Edgar Wright fans, what did you make of the news that he was going to adapt this series for the big screen?
I was not familiar at all with the series of books, and it was one of those ones at the time where sort of I found it hard to sort of get my head around that Edgar Wright was going to make a film that didn't involve Nick Frost, Simon Pegg. It wasn't going to be set in Britain. It was going to be an adapted screenplay. I found all those things slightly jarring in my head of what I expected Edgar Wright to conform to and what I sort of almost had in my head that he should do. Like, I couldn't, these were things that I thought I could never imagine doing otherwise. I know there was always the talk of Ant-Man, but even at that stage it was starting to feel like a pipe dream that this was a film that we were never going to see happen. So I was kind of hesitant at the idea of it being an Edgar Wright film, and kind of wanted them to continue down the road of doing original kind of films.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, because I mean, yeah, it was quite a short out of left field, because, you know, this was, you know, apart from Ant-Man being announced, I think it was probably sort of 2008, 2009 that he and Joe Cornish were going to do the screenplay and he was going to direct, but he sort of pivoted to this one first, and like you say, he was making a name for himself as being a writer director of his own material, writing with Simon Pegg and stuff like that. He'd done Spaced, and then at that point it would have been Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz as well, so, you know, to do something which he wasn't involved in the beginning was an interesting choice. And like you say, the graphic novel series, certainly in the UK over here, I had not heard of it before, but decided to seek it out and eventually got all the graphic novels, although there were only, I think, 5 released by the time it was coming to filming and stuff like that. There was almost a bit of a Game of Thrones sort of thing going on here, where Brian Lee O'Malley was running behind in the publishing of it, and he actually didn't publish episode 6 until the film had actually wrapped, and there was slight differences in the storylines between the final comic and the final film, and also actually there's a few different endings to the film as well, which I'm sure we'll talk about, because I'm sure you've probably got the Blu-ray or DVD with all the special features and stuff like that, have you?
Yeah, that was the first ever Blu-ray I bought.
A bit of history here.
Yeah, to paint my kind of Edgar Wright things, like, we touched on it before, like, how good it used to be when we could get, like, DVDs and Blu-rays jam-packed with, like, special features and so on. And I remember sort of as Blu-rays started to become the thing, or they were kind of, studios were moving towards that, like the DVD extras on you know, would become quite pitiful. I remembered sort of, I think it was just after Christmas, I remembered whenever I sort of go up and stay in Aberdeen, I usually have to stay like an extra full day on Boxing Day because the trains don't run again until the 27th. So I always kind of want to get out of a bit of cabin fever, and I always head to HMV to like browse some of the new titles that came out. And I remember just sort of looking at the Scott Pilgrim DVD that had like next to no special features on it, but the Blu-ray edition had what I love on the Edgar Wright things, like a feature-length documentary all about the making of it. And I was like, I think this is the moment that's finally come. Like, I want to watch the film again, but I also want to watch the behind-the-scenes information, sort of see how Wright created this really fantastic film. So that encouraged me to upgrade finally.
I see. Wow, that's interesting, because I actually hadn't realised that the DVD didn't have much in the way of extras, because, like you say, the Cornetto trilogy has sort of lovely, a lot of normally like 3 to 4 audio commentaries, and you get the sort of A-board sort of screenplay to how Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg sort of block out how they go about structuring and writing their screenplay and stuff. But I mean, I didn't wait for it to come out in the UK. I bought it from America, because it was I'm looking at my American Blu-ray here, which is region free, and claims to be the ultimate Scott Pilgrim experience, with deleted scenes, bloopers, feature commentaries, making ofs, a Blu-ray exclusive, a limited time only. Apparently, with this Blu-ray disc, I can instantly stream a movie to my TV or smartphone.
My God.
Heady days. A combo pack that apparently will play on my PS3. It's a brave new world. Brave new world. But, so do you remember the first time that you saw the film?
Yeah, I saw opening weekend on a Sunday, and this stung me when, I think it was like a couple of weeks ago, when Entertainment Weekly did the oral history for the 10th anniversary of like Scott Pilgrim. I was like, and I just remember, just, it's very rare that I get floored by these things. Like, I like to think I get time. I remember just being like, I saw this film 10 years ago. And I really struggled with the concept that I had seen it that long ago. It feels like a film that has, I don't know about you, but like 5 years ago, that seems realistic, maybe 6 or 7, but 10 seemed unbelievable. But yeah, it was opening weekend on a Sunday, and I saw it with a couple of friends. I certainly came away with it really happy. One of my other friends was much more kind of negative on it.
Yeah, I mean, 10 years, it's like the scene in Gross Point Blank where Jeremy Piven's just driving along the car and then just starts screaming at John Cusack, 10 years, 10 years, 10 years. I mean, it doesn't seem that long ago, but apparently it is. Who knows where the time goes. But I remember seeing it for the first time in MovieCon 3 when Empire did their sort of weekend of sort of film previews and teaser trailers and stuff like that, along with apparently secret screenings of a film. The year before, they'd done District 9 as a secret screening, and it had remained a secret. Apparently nobody told Edgar Wright that it was a secret, that it was going to be Scott Pilgrim. And he tweeted this, which then led to the situation where it was a real struggle to get tickets, which then forced them to then basically try and upgrade and go to the O2 arena for their next one, and it wasn't as successful. So yeah, Edgar Wright was responsible for creating a terrible, terrible situation trying to book tickets via C-tickets, and leading to the wonderful line when we were all introduced to MovieCon with, now you know what the C in C-ticket stands for. Hmm. So, but it was a great screening there. Edgar Wright was there to introduce it. Brian Lee O'Malley as well, and I managed to get my episode 6 signed by the both of them, so that was very good.
Well, I've got my number 1 signed by Brian Lee O'Malley, but not Edgar Wright.
Not Edgar Wright. I told Edgar Wright to take a day off and stop drinking so many espressos, because he was clearly having he works very, very hard and basically never seems to take any time off. So I told him to take a chill pill. So it was he deserved a break after this before going on to the next project. But I mean, it went down really well at MovieCon, as far as I'm aware. It went down really well at Comic-Con in San Diego. Universal thought they had a major hit on their hands, and it turned out to not really be that. It only cost around about 35-40 million on its production budget, but struggled to make that back at the US and worldwide box office. I mean, I remember the reviews being strong, especially in the UK. Everyone was still hugely up for Edgar Wright films at that point. But I mean, do you know why it maybe didn't connect with wider audiences? Was it the fact that at this point it maybe just suffered from not being a Marvel or DC movie?
I think there's probably a few kind of reasons, and I remembered sort of, I think a couple months earlier before sort of its release in America, I was over there for kind of that Christmas, like sort of summer. I was there for a wedding, and I went to see Toy Story 3, which was kind of still showing there in America at the time, sort of ahead of sort of any sort of UK date. And I remembered going into this New York cinema, and there was like a huge mural for Scott Pilgrim that was coming soon with the, like, it's the red one with Scott Pilgrim kind of playing the guitar. I think for people that, like, you kind of listed off this incredible cast earlier on, it's not really a cast if you're like a member of the Joe Public at the time, of like Michael Cera. The hipsters knew him from Arrested Development. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, that girl from Death Proof. Kieran Culkin, his brother is kind of more famous at the time. Chris Evans, wasn't he the guy from that dodgy Fantastic Four film? Anna Kendrick, probably not much of a, you know, name recognition there. Alison Pill.
Twilight, yeah. She was a bit part in Twilight.
There you go. Alison Pill, you know, long before she sort of kind of broke out with things like Newsroom, sort of other kind of films, Star Trek Picard. Brandon Routh, he was Superman one time. Jason Schwartzman, hipsters and indie kids with their kind of film. And Edgar Wright as well, like, he, you know, his films were probably popular in these sorts of like South by Southwest kind of Comic Con circles. That's probably not enough to kind of carry through a film to have a big opening weekend sort of in a very kind of crowded sort of American market at the time. And as you say, neither of us had sort of heard of Scott Pilgrim at all at the time in terms of the book, and I don't know how popular it was. I mean, it was a black and white series at the time. They've obviously since released it in sort of color version, so it's one of those ones that it was a perfect storm for probably people not to find it, despite the really good trailers and buzz. It the best thing I remembered from the Entertainment Weekly, you know, oral history of the 10 years was that after the weekend, and it became clear that the film was going to be a bit of a flop, to be honest, was that the producer at sort of Universal, the executive, sent Edgar Wright a message that said years, not days, about the film would eventually become a success and be seen and be popular.
Yeah, no, I think that's the thing, because, you know, the fact that we're, you know, doing this episode 10 years on, and the fact it was certainly due to get a re-release in cinemas on the 10th anniversary, which I think is around the 10th of August was when it finally came out. But whether that goes ahead or not, perhaps in Canada, maybe it'll have a bigger splash up there. But like you say, I mean, yeah, if you looked at the cast today, I mean, that is a hell of a cast. But back in 2010, it was all sort of stars on the rise. I mean, I think when I saw this, I hadn't even seen any sort of Parks and Rec or anything like that, so I wasn't really aware of Aubrey Plaza. I mean, if you look at it now, yeah, it's like Michael Cera basically kicks the ass of Captain America, a Superman. He dates Huntress from Birds of Prey. I mean, it's crazy to think just the sheer level of talent in this. And that's one thing that Edgar Wright is great at, is spotting talent on the rise. I mean, like you say, Anna Kendrick, this was before, you know, she was Oscar nominated for Up in the Air and stuff like that. And, you know, it's looking back on it, I mean, it's just incredible to get that level of talent in a film, which apparently, yeah, the budget was actually $85 million, and it did a worldwide box office of $47 million. But I think given the sort of Blu-ray sales and DVD sales, I think it probably has is probably eking towards turning a profit finally after those 10 years. But I mean, what was it in particular that appealed to you when you saw it? Because I mean, for me personally, I actually think this is Edgar Wright's best film in terms of sort of the direction. In, you know, it's amazing that a studio set, Universal, basically allowed him to put his full stamp on it. You know, you can tell it's an Edgar Wright film from either the shots and the style and use of music and stuff like that. It really is an Edgar Wright comic book movie, probably more than certainly Ant-Man ever would have been, which is probably why he ended up walking away in the end. So, I mean, did you sort of feel like it was an Edgar Wright film when it was released?
Yeah, like, I agree with you. I think this is his best film. I think this edges out Shaun of the Dead. I just think this is, like, his... You watch this kind of lineage from sort of Spaced, the type of slackers, the type of people involved, and this just it seems so... The kind of work of Brian Lee O'Malley, which a lot of these kind of little scenes, if you've kind of read the books, will sort of, like, echo that, but, like, he brings so much, like, every scene has, like, there's just something going on, the sound design level, the cinematography, framing, acting. It's one of those ones, like, the film, I think when I logged it on Letterboxd today, I'd logged it six times. I would say that's six times, probably at least, sort of over the 10 years. You know, seeing it at the cinema, watching it again. A couple of years ago, they did a fantastic event at the Edinburgh Film Festival where they did this as sort of a live event where they had, like, you watch the film in sort of a university hall and then you went into sort of this, like, castle-like dorm area and you got to, like, do some video gaming. There was, like, zines, there was bands on stage, like, themed cocktails. It was just the best time. So it's been one of those ones, like, when you kind of watch it every single time, even watching sort of the live read through, there's something where you think, oh, I never picked up on that joke, and there's probably so many references that still fly over my head because I'm not like a video gamer. I don't get some of those references, but I do get some of the television stuff, the film stuff, the book stuff, whereas the video gaming, I'm sort of left behind. So even after all these kind of years, the film still has so much deeper meaning than even I can grasp.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of the stylistic stuff that he does is amazing. I mean, I remember there was one particular bit where Scott Pilgrim goes for a pee and you've got the sort of pee bar sort of draining away and he comes into the room, shuts the door, you know, does his business, does a very poor attempt of washing his hands. Certainly you need to do a lot more in sort of COVID situations than that. And then opens the door, enter, goes into a completely different corridor. And apparently they did that all in shot, basically. The toilet would have been like a set on wheels and it would have closed the door and then they would have moved it to the new set all while doing that and then opened up into that. So, I mean, that's the kind of sort of stuff, you know, he's clearly a director who basically will have every single moment shot, edit, storyboarded in his head before he goes to do it. And, you know, I think it's it. But, I mean, it's even without that, as you mentioned there, one of the things that came up recently was the fact that the cast and crew did a sort of live cast table read over the internet, online, in order to raise money for a charity, which was Water for People. And it was still an enjoyable film. Well, I say film, not a film. It's still an enjoyable experience to watch the cast do the table read. I mean, you didn't need, I mean, it came in at around about, I think, about an hour and a half, so it was about sort of 15 minutes shorter than the actual film because you've cut out all the action and stuff like that, but it was still really enjoyable to read, to watch that and sort of see the cast sort of 10 years. They clearly still love the movie. The fact that they managed to get almost everyone along, apart from, I think it was maybe Kieran Culkin and Brie Larson, were about the only two noticeable absentees from it. Although I have to say, the one thing that did disappoint me about the table read, I don't know if you noticed it, but the best line in the film was cut, and that was Chris Evans laughing at his own phone, going, "That's actually hilarious." For some reason, that wasn't there, so it must have been an ad lib and not in the script, so that's why it was missing. But I mean, this is a film which has taught us so much. I mean, I never knew that bread made you fat until Scott Pilgrim. And so, you know, it's great life advice. You know, you need to know these things. And, you know, 10 years on, whenever I have garlic bread or have a loaf of bread or something, I sit there going, is that going to make me fat? I don't know. So, I mean, what did you make of the table read?
I loved it. I thought Ellen Wong as Knives Chow was the highlight of the video conference, because she was just like, she threw herself right into it. Some of them are like, they're doing the lines, you know, they've got quite a lot of dialogue. Like, Ellen Wong was like, she was acting it out. She was like so up for it. And I've got to give full props to Mae Whitman for her flexible legs as well. So, you know, I thought it was really good. And I loved that they could edit it a little bit as well. So you get some of the screen wipes. I thought that was really quite fun. Brian Lee O'Malley doing the kind of some of the drawings in real time as well. It really put a big smile on my face this morning. Like, I had it on in the background while I started working from home again after a week off work, and I think I did more watching than working from home. It was a real treat. I had been kind of planning to watch it for the past couple of weeks, and today was finally day. And I, as you say, the runtime is still really good, so it's like a nice treat to kind of dive into that. And I thought they were all great, and I just, you know, it's always good to see the stars' bedrooms and spare rooms and kitchens as well. So yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, I mean, Ellen Wong is fantastic. She's someone who I thought really was a breakout star when this came out, and I really wanted to see more from her, but I didn't really see any much of her over the last 10 years, although I found out now that she's basically in Glow, the sort of wrestling comedy series on Netflix. So I'm going to try giving that a watch because I love wrestling as well. I'm surprised I haven't gotten into it yet already, but she's had like a few small roles, but I thought she was going to really sort of break out, but it didn't really happen. But yeah, no, she was having a great time. There was some great stuff in there, like Brandon Routh still has the t-shirt, Todd's t-shirt, so he had that on. I think there was a great tweet I saw about Chris Evans and how basically he can go from looking like, you know, the best boyfriend in the world and turning by arching his eyebrows, turning into someone who looks like he'd use females to describe women and stuff like that. It was great. He was great and really sort of got into it. He had he nipped off after his character was killed, so he didn't hang around for the rest of it. It was great to see him enjoying himself. But I think, and like you say, it was great to see the fact that they had pre-recorded it. They got to do a lot more with like the visuals, so you got like the sort of comic book effects and stuff like that. So it was great. But I love the fact that Aubrey Plaza managed to basically self bleep herself and cover her mouth with a little prop and stuff like that. I thought she was, for me, she was the standout of the performance. I thought that was great. But actually, I want to ask about sort of these sort of table reads, because I know, is it Jason Reitman's done several sort of live readings in the past where it's not the original cast, and what you get is he gets his sort of friends to come along, and you get people reading different parts. You know, they've done Princess Bride, Breakfast Club, Big Lebowski and stuff like that. Were you okay with the original cast doing their parts again, or would you maybe like to have seen, you know, a recasting of it, perhaps with Jesse Eisenberg as Scott Pilgrim, perhaps, since they always get the two of them mixed up anyway?
In this case, no, I was really happy to see this cast reunited, because it's like one of the most perfect bits of casting is this kind of film. So no, I was really happy with that. I mean, table reads can be a mixed bag for sure. There's something that me and kind of Mike Schindler have been discussing, you know, does some podcasting here on the Nerd Party, where they recently did a Star Trek Discovery table read for Comic Con, where it was like the Star Trek Discovery cast. Here's your, if you're listening at home drinking, taking the drinking game, Lee brings up Star Trek, where they were sort of talking about, you know, we're going to go do this table read for this scene. And it was like a scene that never really stuck out to me in my head. It was like the act one of the season finale. And we were kind of discussing it, where it was like, when you've got this cast together, like, mix it up. Give, like, all the people different roles. Get them to go do, like, a different film altogether. So part of me would be tempted to see, like, the Scott Pilgrim cast do Shaun of the Dead. I think that could be something that would be highly interesting. So who would you cast, like, Kieran Culkin as? Who would Chris Evans be? Who would Ellen Wong be? Like, I think you could have kind of a fun discussion where it was, like, recast Shaun of the Dead with the cast of Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and, like, you know, mix up the genders, go nuts. I would be very interested in watching that, and perhaps even discussing that one day.
Yeah, no, I can see that. Could we have? I think Chris Evans seems like he could play a stoner type. I think he. What if he played Ed?
Yeah, that could be interesting.
I could see that.
I think Brandon Routh would be a good Ed.
You think? Yeah, Brandon Routh would be a good Ed. Yeah, I think Jason Schwartzman should be Sean. I think that'd be interesting, and then, or maybe you even gender swap it.
Yeah.
Maybe have a Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Shauna of the Dead.
Yeah, I think there we go. See, that is like as a podcast in itself, as lockdown continues, recasting Shauna of the Dead with a Scott Pilgrim cast. I'm very much up for this, and see if we can come to a consensus or what our pairings would be.
Yeah, and then, there's a lot of characters in Hot Fuzz as well, I'm sure.
Yes.
So, I mean, in terms of like Scott Pilgrim, I mean, what sort of scenes sort of stand out for you sort of 10 years on as highlights? Is there any sort of particular evil ex fight or anything like that that, you know, still brings you a smile to your face after all these years?
I think like the highlights of the film continue to be sort of all the Wallace Wells scenes. Like I think Kieran Culkin is perfectly cast as Wallace, and just sort of, you know, the antics that he gets up to, how he stitches up all the other kind of, you know, his mates around him, steals their boyfriends. And it's one of these films, like, I think every character in this is pretty shady, has, you know, are a bit morally bankrupt, not the best people in the world sometimes, apart from lovely like Knives. And I quite like watching the film sometimes where I almost think, okay, this is Scott Pilgrim's hero's journey, but it's also about, you know, young Knives being able to sort of become her own person, sort of, you know, make peace with Scott and kind of go on and have a, you know, a happy life and so on. And I think she's sometimes the true hero of the film, you know, her rise from young school kid to sort of like ass-kicking hero that sort of combines forces with Ramona and Scott to overcome the odds.
Yeah, because actually that leads me on to the alternate endings of the film, because I know they sort of went back and forth on this about who Scott should end up with. You know, there is an alternative ending where he basically doesn't go with Ramona and goes with Knives as well. So, I mean, what did you make of the ending on first viewing? Do you think it was the right ending? Would you have liked to have seen him end up with Knives, or was Knives right to say that basically she's too cool for Scott now? And basically, he should have been kicked to the curb by both of them, perhaps, because, yeah, his behaviour is not the best at times.
No, I agree. I think, like, after you go through all that effort of defeating all these evil exes, and I think, like, they probably owe it to themselves, Scott and Ramona, to give it a try. I think the reality is that, you know, as saying, Knives is, like, she is too cool for him now, but she is, like, the best person in this whole kind of film and stuff. She's just too nice, too cool. All the rest are sort of like, you know, self-obsessed, you know, terrible gossips, you know, vile language. Knives is just really wholesome, and I think Scott should make a good relationship, kind of, you know, friendship with Knives. But I think the best ending is that sort of Scott and Ramona give it a go. I think if Scott had sort of gone in the alternative take with Knives, I think that doesn't sort of line up with how it feels like in the film. It feels slightly disingenuous, and that, like, it wasn't quite the right journey all the way through. That's my feeling anyway. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, I think at the end it's the right call, because, yeah, I think Knives has proved that she's better than Scott, and I think it'd be a step down for by that point to go out with him, given how she was treated by him. And, you know, there is another amazing sort of theory or potential alternative ending. They never filmed it, but they did talk about it, and it's one which I really like. And it's basically that they would have cut to like a news report about how a young Toronto man kills 7 people, and the fact that basically Scott Pilgrim, in order to get Ramona, turned into a serial killer and in his own head created this weird video game style scenario in order to justify the murders and stuff like that. That is a ending I would have liked to have seen. I think that's a really interesting take on the thing, and a really sort of dark way for the story to go.
Yeah, that is a really interesting take, and I just love that it is this hyper reality where it's like, oh, people are getting like smashed into coins. Like, oh, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, no, it's like the first fight with Matthew Patel and stuff like that. It's like what, and it's like everyone's like going, what is going on here? And then it's like it goes into a musical number, because I know Edgar Wright had talked about how he basically wanted to film it as a musical, but with the fights as the music numbers. So, you know, each one is different. You've got like a Bollywood one, you've got action one, you've got bass one, you've got the music one with the Asian twins there as well. For me, I mean, I love Lucas Lee as a character. I think Chris Evans just nails it. It's one of my favorite performances of his, inspired by the, I think it was Edgar Wright meeting a member of the lead singer of The Hives or something, which inspired the line, hey, big fan, he says, why wouldn't you be? And, you know, it's just so good. And I always have this theory that whenever Chris Evans has a beard, it's a better performance from him. He acts better with a beard, so Snowpiercer, parts of Sunshine, etc. I think he's really good in something like that. And yeah, it's just, and also it's funny, sort of thinking back sort of 10 years ago, it's like veganism, it was a thing, but it wasn't as big as it is now. And it's interesting to see the sort of jokes made about it, and the fact that, you know, I've actually become basically vegan myself. I don't partake of chicken parmesan, or I might maybe have the occasional gelato, which is why I haven't got my full vegan powers yet. But it's funny that was one of the things as well that it showcased sort of Brandon Routh as someone who had a lot of untapped potential. You know, I think he unfairly seemed to get a lot of the criticism for the underwhelming Superman Returns. I thought he was a very good Superman, and Clark Kent, it just was basically rehashing Superman 2 again. And there was also some really dodgy stuff about the fact that, you know, sort of spying, and basically, how did he get Lois Lane pregnant? Because in one version of Superman 2, he basically wiped her mind. So, I mean, would she not be questioning that? So, I mean, yeah, that's a whole other episode to get into. But, I mean, the whole sort of the cleaning lady and the dust thing I thought was fantastic. And, I mean, what did you make of his performance? I think you said he was one of your favorites when you saw him sort of first time
around. Yeah, I liked kind of Brandon Routh in this role. I'd only really seen him sort of in the Superman film before. And it was one of those ones, I watched this and I thought, like, I think he's going to have a renaissance where he's going to go on and sort of be seen more sort of in some of these kind of comedy roles, because I thought his timing was excellent. Even when we were sort of watching the live table read, I just thought he was so good. So it was kind of disappointing to see that sort of, you know, he's kind of done some Superman stuff. It seems to be majority kind of TV that he's on. I just feel like, you know, he should be in things like that are a bit more sort of, you know, it's all fine if you want to star in things like Arrow and the Flash and stuff like that. It's no judgment on his career. But, like, I would love to be seeing him in comedy performances and films. I think he's got a real touch for it.
Yeah, no, so directors, cast same directors, writers, whatever, you know, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, she's in a lot, she's doing okay. Michael Cera's in a lot. Chris Evans, he's not got any worries. But what we want to see is more Brandon Routh. We want more Ellen Wong in things. So, you know, let's make it happen. Let's get them out there. So, sort of, any sort of final thoughts on the legacy of Scott Pilgrim? I mean, like you say, you've seen it now at least, you've logged it at least 6 times in 10 years. Is it one that, you know, you're always going to go back to and enjoy? And, you know, what would it be, how would you try and sell it to someone who maybe hasn't seen it yet, and it's going to be on at the cinemas when they reopen, if they reopen? Why should people go along and see it?
I think it's one of those ones. I think people are more and more have probably caught this film on DVD. I think the amount of us that have probably caught it at the cinema are probably a bit too slim, just due to sort of its runtime as well. And I think a film like this, it's like, you've probably really enjoyed it on DVD, you've probably watched it on Netflix, why don't you give it a go in the cinema? You know, it's, yes, there's kind of other things, you know, Star Wars and, you know, Dark Knight and Batman's that people are competing for people's attention to, if people even want to go to the cinemas. But, you know, why don't you go give Scott Pilgrim a go on sort of the big screen, sort of a film that didn't make all the billions that these other films did at the time. Go see it, go support it, you know, see something like this. And I think you'll have a great time. You know, there's, as I say, there's still so much that I get on it on repeat viewings, and I think it's well one to support. And, you know, go see it if you're celebrating its 10th anniversary, or go see it for the first time if you never got the chance to feel old when you saw that news.
Yeah, no, I think it's one which I would, this is a film which I would certainly go back and see on the big screen once the cinemas reopen. I think there's so much to get out of it in terms of even just sort of like little background details, like the one of the bus scenes, the sort of when they're driving by, it's like you've got X's in the window, or and then hearts in the window and stuff like that whenever things are going good or bad for Scott and stuff like that. So I think there's loads of little details that you can pick up on and really enjoy. And I think, yeah, it's just the fact that it's just such a well-crafted, well-acted movie that it's impossible not to enjoy it while it's on. It's the kind of film which, if it was on such heavy rotation as all other Edgar Wright films are on ITV2, if ITV2 picked up this one and had it on every night, if it ever popped on the TV at any point, I would end up watching it to the end, because I just think it's a fantastic film. And yeah, it deserves a bigger audience. And I think now that 10 years, I think that's a decent amount of time that, yeah, people are starting to realise that they maybe missed out on it first time round. But luckily, with the wonderful world of Blu-ray and streaming and stuff like that, there's it's never too late to discover this film for the first time. So there we go. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, 2 thumbs up. But, you know, we're not always here to talk about one particular film. We've always got other little things we like to recommend, whether that is not going to the cinema and enjoying something on TV, podcasting, radio. Who knows what it's going to be? So what have you picked for us this week?
Yeah, I've gone for, I mentioned their podcast earlier on, and it's one of those ones, I felt like I'm one of these memes the other day where I think you see it where it's like, has a picture of someone just listening to a podcast and going, just laughing away or agreeing with something that people are saying. I found that recently where I was sort of listening to Film Damage by Mike Schindler, who does some stuff here on the network. Him and Max have this fantastic kind of relationship where Mike's the enthusiastic one and Max is sort of the droll, sort of unenthusiastic kind of person about whatever Mike gets excited about. So I kind of touched on it earlier. I loved their episode recently where they were like, okay, instead of getting the Star Trek Discovery cast to do this, you know, act that no one remembers, just cast them in something completely different, and how would they do it? And I was just laughing away sort of as they kind of spoke about all that. And they do like audio commentaries. They have a fantastic series at the moment where they look at like the time travel and things like Back to the Future, The Naked Time, 12 Monkeys, Past Tense, Bill and Ted's Adventure. And they sort of break down if the time travel makes sense, and they do it in such a fun way. They're really fun podcast to listen to. They're one of the definitely the most underrated film podcasts that are out there, and they're one of my favorite double acts. So yeah, if you want to laugh along like me, definitely check out Film Damage.
I definitely will, and add that onto my rotation. I do love a good in-depth talk about time travel discrepancies in movies. It's always a fun thing. It was one of the things that I ended up talking to the director of James versus his future self at the Glasgow Film Festival. I think we spent about 20 minutes in the episode just going on about the different versions of, I think it was like Avengers and then Back to the Futures and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I always could enjoy an episode like that. But for me, recommending this week is something which is out on Blu-ray next week, August 10th, and it is The Woman in Black, not the one with Harry Potter, but the one with Harry Potter's dad, Adrian Rollins, because long before Daniel Radcliffe was probably even a twinkle in his dad's eye, there was a TV movie version that came out on Christmas Eve on ITV, and basically has been nigh on impossible to find until now. A company have put it together on a special Blu-ray package. It's been restored, looks fantastic, and is the, I'm not going to say the original version of the Susan Hill link, because I think the original version was the fantastic stage show, which if you ever get a chance to see is properly crap your pants scary. And this is a really interesting version of it. It is actually very scary for essentially a TV movie of it, but it does have a lot of foreboding and dread in it. And there's also some fantastic special features, including an audio commentary from Kim Newman horror writer and film reviewer, Mark Gatiss from Sherlock and League of Gentlemen, and Andy Nyman, who has done Ghost Stories and also had a small part in this as well. And they sort of talk about the making of and provide it. It's one of those commentaries where they do enjoy the film, but they're not directly related to the film, so they can cast a critical eye on it, but also they provide a lot of good sort of factoids and also how various elements of the film has inspired them in their work as well. So that is out next week, and I can highly recommend that. I can actually highly recommend the Hammer version with Harry Potter as well. I thought it was actually a pretty good version, and I do remember a family going to see that film at Cineworld with a young kid because it was a 12A, and the kid was basically screaming in terror the entire time, and they had to take him out, and I was just like, you fools.
Oh, no.
So yeah, there we go. But that brings us to an end of another episode. Next week we are going to be back with Kim as we do a special episode inspired by the Nerd Party's House of Fincher podcast, and we're going to look at Seven and basically choose our own special playlists built around the seven deadly sins. And you know, I'll be sticking to the rules, but I'm really looking forward to the what you're going to somehow have a really tenuous link to and stuff like that. I can't wait to hear what you've got lined up. Have you already been thinking about it?
No, but I did have some practice last week. I was on a friend of the show's Trek Ranks, where like you're prime directive is you have to like pick a five theme, and I had to pick five movie villains from the Star Trek movies, and I made the rule with myself that I will not include any of the main villains, and I had to be the most obtuse as possible. So I picked things like Captain Kirk, I picked a house fire, so yeah, I'm sure I'll find a way to be innovative and induce some groans from you and Kim.
Absolutely. Did you choose J.J. Abrams for Into Darkness?
Ooh, no, I did not, no.
Well, I do look forward to that. I'm sure you're going to come up with some absolute belters. So join us next week for that. But in the meantime, I might be a vegan, and now it's time for us to be gone. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.